What's your favorite game? The games humans play can teach us a lot about psychology and culture, according to Marcus de Sautoy, the author of the new book, Around the World in 80 Games, From Tarot to Tic-Tac-Toe, Catan to Chutes and Ladders, a mathematician unlocks the secrets of the world's greatest games. Marcus is Simonis Professor for the Public Understanding of Science and a professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford. He's a fellow of the Royal Society and has written for The Guardian, The Times, and The Daily Telegraph. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
My name's Marcus de Sautoy. I'm a mathematician and author of Around the World in 80 Games. I love playing games. When I travel, I love to seek out the games that the people I'm visiting love playing too. I think the games give us a great insight into the culture, the heritage, the character of the country that I'm visiting. Kind of tell me the game you play and I'll tell you who you are. So for years, I've actually been collecting games wherever I travel, but I've now decided I wanted to share this secret passion with readers. So that's why I've written this new book, Around the World in 80 Games, about the different variety of games that fill my office at home. But a curious thing happened when I gathered the games and the game themes I wanted to talk about, and I wrote them down on filing cards. I got a rather pleasant surprise because it turned out I had exactly 80. So I couldn't resist calling the book Around the World in 80 Games. And I had a curious revelation when I reread Jules Verne's book, Around the World in 80 Days. I discovered the games actually play quite an important role in this book. Because Phileas Fogg loves playing games too. So on his journey around the world, rather than looking out the window at the wonderful view of Mumbai coming into sight on as he comes in on the boat, Phileas Fogg is playing whist. And in fact, as he arrives in Mumbai, he's just winning a grand slam of 13 tricks. So games are also an important part of that book too. Now, of course, in Jules Verne's book, there's actually an 81st day because going around the world, you get kind of an extra day out of the journey. So I thought I would add an extra game to my book, which is actually to make the book itself a game. So you can read the book from game one to game 80, or you could use a dice and jump around the book, randomly choosing which game you're going to read next. And I calculated how many different ways you can generate to read this book. And it turns out it's a number with 61 digits. So if you read a book every second since the Big Bang, then the number of books you could have read, now that'll only have about 18 digits. So the chances are that the book you generate will never have been read before and will never be read again. Six to start, two no trumps, knight to c3. These are the opening lines of some of humanity's greatest games. Games for me are a little bit like stories. We sit around the kitchen table, or maybe many years ago around the campfire, and a game provided a way somehow to bind our group, our community together. But for me, the interesting difference between games and stories are that games a way of being very active participants in that stories. I mean, stories can make us cry, but a game can make us feel guilty because of our actions. I think our species loves playing games, not just as children, but unusually throughout our adult life. Some have even suggested that we should be known as Homo ludens, not Homo sapiens. Games, it's been suggested, offer a kind of space, a safe space to explore our universe. As we understood that our universe was governed by rules, then we started to develop these games which are controlled by rules and to explore what the implications of those rules are. Others have suggested that actually it's a tool for exploring our inner worlds, our consciousness, that to play a game actually requires theory of mind, the ability to think, well, what is your opponent going to do next and plan accordingly? In fact, I discovered on my travels that games are used in India in arranged marriages to help a new couple to get to know each other. So games are very much an expression of our free will and our agency. We choose to play the game, and the decisions we make within the game are kind of an expression of our character. You may wonder why a mathematician rather than an anthropologist or a historian is writing this book about games. But for me, maths and games actually have a lot in common. A game is a set of rules, a bit like the axioms of mathematics, and playing a game is like exploring the consequences of those rules, a bit like proving a theorem. If you understand the maths underlying a game, it can give you a real edge. So this book is full of useful mathematical tips that I've picked up to help you win games. For example, Monopoly. What are the best properties to buy in Monopoly? Well, what's the most visited square on the Monopoly board? Turns out it's the jail square, because you can just land on that square, or you can land on the square diagonally opposite, which sends you to jail, or you might pick up a chance card, which sends you to jail. If you roll three doubles in a row, that actually is punished by sending you to jail. So it turns out the jail square is three times more likely to be visited than any other square on the Monopoly board. But on the other hand, you can't buy the jail square. However, if you now consider what's the most common roll of a dice from the jail square, well, it turns out that seven is the most common throw of two dice. Why? Because there are six ways to make a seven. Six and one, five and two, four and three and four, two and five, one and six. Whilst two or 12, there's only one way to make each of those. So actually, out of jail, people are most likely to throw a 6, 7 or 8, which lands them in the orange region of properties. So here's my little hint for you. The math says that the orange properties are going to give you an edge in this game. And it turns out many games, if you understand the underlying maths, that you can actually give you a real advantage in playing the game. So for me, one of the theses of the book is that games are a way of playing mathematics. One of the favourite continents that I visit on my journey around the world in 80 games is India, because India is a country which seems to love playing games, and some of the great games have their origins in India. For example, chess, one of the great games of all time, started in India. But I found something rather curious about chess and its origins, because originally it wasn't a two-player game, but a four-player game, and you had four armies competing on the board, and you might capture somebody else's army and make it your own. And this is why, actually, in the two-player game, we see two rooks, two knights, two bishops, because it's the amalgamation of two different armies. The other curious fact that I discovered is that originally a dice was used to play chess. So you would throw a dice in order to decide which piece you were allowed to move next. So you didn't have complete freedom to move any piece. The dice decided which piece you had to move. And when gambling was banned in India, they had to remove the dice, and then players said, well, actually, we can play this game without a dice, and it became a pure strategy game. Another game which I was quite surprised had its origins in India is Snakes and Ladders, a game I played a lot with my sister when I was a kid. But it turns out that Snakes and Ladders actually was a game to help teach the importance of karma in order to reach nirvana or moksha. That's the snakes were about bad karma, and they would often be labelled with things like drunkenness, which will send you back to the beginning, and good deeds, like helping your neighbour, would be rewarded by climbing up a ladder. So this was actually a tool to teach about the goal of getting to moksha, and the square that you would aim for would be a kind of nirvana. And if you missed it, then you would actually get reborn and have to go around the board again. So it turns out that Snakes and Ladders, game many kids play, actually has deep spiritual origins in India. What makes a great game? Well, I've come up with a few qualities that I think make a really good game. The first thing is that it shouldn't really finish before it's even started. even if you're not as good as your opponent, there should be a chance that you can still win. So, for example, Donald Trump against Garry Kasparov at chess. That's not going to be a very interesting game, whilst perhaps if they're playing snakes and ladders, then there's a chance either of them could win. Second, I think it's really important that the game shouldn't finish before it ends. The best games are those in which, right out to the last moment, there still remains a chance that anyone could win. I think this is why Monopoly is actually not a very good game, because very quickly it becomes clear who owns most properties, and it just, the game becomes one of grinding out the bankruptcy of all the other players. I think this means that invariably you actually want an element of chance in a game to kind of equalise everything. But chance alone, I don't think, is enough. There should be some role for strategy and agency, or else the player is converted into little more than a machine implementing the rules of the game. For example, in Snakes and Ladders, you don't really play much role beyond just throwing the dice to see what's going to happen next. The fourth quality, I think, is that you should have simple rules, but that should give rise to really interesting variety in the ways the game is played. So simple rules allow you to get playing quickly, but the variety provided by multiplying possibilities makes the game worth returning to again and again. And the last quality, the fifth one, I think is a good story is paramount. It doesn't mean you have to have castles and goblins, but still, I think like a good piece of mathematics, a rewarding game has a really compelling narrative arc to it. And if I was going to choose a game which I think passes all of these five tests, then the first game in the book is the one that I would recommend. It's Backgammon. It's a beautiful game. I learnt it when I was on the beaches in Sinai. And for me, this is a game which combines those beautiful qualities of having a bit of uncertainty and randomness because of the dice. But even if you get bad throws of the dice, you can still use strategy to win. And it turns out that backgammon is also one of the most ancient games that humanity has created.
Thank you, Marcus. That was five big ideas from Around the World in 80 Games by Marcus de Sotoy. You might also like our book bite for The Beauty of Games by Helen Weldon. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.